Call the committee to order. The clerk will note the roll. We need two more members, but we would like to start and at least get the presentation started in Representative Eastland's bill. The clerk will note the roll and the quorum is present. Representative Hamilton moves approval of the minutes for May 10th. Any questions, changes, deletions? Actually, Representative Gunther moves approval of the minutes. Any discussion? Seeing none, those in favor say aye. Those opposed, nay. The minutes are approved. The chair will move. Oh, we have another set of minutes from May 15th. Representative Earhart moves approval of the minutes from May 15th. Any discussion? Seeing none, those in favor say aye. Those opposed, nay. The minutes are adopted. The chair will move that House File 4112 be recommended to pass and be referred to the General Register. Representative Eastland, welcome to the committee. If you could give us a brief description of your bill. My understanding is that the provision Representative Eastland is presenting is in bill. Representative Hilty will be presenting tomorrow, but we thought we would allow the courtesy of Representative Eastland to have this bill sent to the register. Representative Eastland, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is the it's called the Safe at Home Bill. It was initiated by the Secretary of State's office. What it basically does is it provides a way to give a person an anonymous address, particularly in the cases where there's abuse and there's a need for people to be anonymous from somebody that may be stalking them. What this bill does is it allows the Secretary of State to create a system that would allow them to have an address that they could use, a legal address for voting, for their driver's license, for all of their legal needs, that would not be traceable, so that a person could actually physically find them.
Thank you.
Well, I have a DE1 amendment, first of all.
The chair will move the DE1 amendment. This is a reflective of the negotiations that have taken place at the Secretary of State's office. Representative Eastland.
Okay, the DE1 amendment simply does a couple of things. It just makes a few technical corrections that needed to be made in the bill. And the other thing it does is it pushes the effective date out to 2007, which is allows the policy of the bill to be passed without having any cost in this biennium.
Questions for Representative Eastland on the DE1 amendment? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. The amendment is adopted.
Basically, what we're doing here tonight is just trying to create a safety valve. This bill, as it is amended right now, is in the elections bill exactly as we have it before us. I have every reason to believe that it's going to pass. But if for some reason things do deteriorate, this would give us a safety valve and give us a way to keep this bill alive and handle it in another way. So that's basically the reason we're here tonight.
Any questions for Representative Eastland? Seeing none, the chair will renew his motion that House File 4112 be recommended to pass and be referred to the General Register as amended. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. The bill is passed.
Thank you.
Congratulations, Representative Eastland. The next bill on the docket is Senate File 2239. Representative Smith, if you would come up to the testimony table. Representative Smith moves that Senate File 2239 be recommended to pass, be referred to the General Register. Okay. We are waiting for copies. Do you have some copies that have been made yet? Okay. Do we have copies of the Osmond bill? Representative Smith, members, we do not have copies for every member of the Senate File 2239. We had a copier machine break. Members, are you comfortable having Representative Smith walk through the bill as the copier machine is making copies for members? Representative Solberg?
Let's do that in the same time, but then I think we will allow us to have amendments.
Yep. Sure. Members, are we comfortable with letting the presentation go forward without the bill in front of us? We do have possession. The committee does have possession of the bill. So, Representative Smith, welcome to the committee. You're a member of the committee. If you could just give us a overview. We are now have some copies that are coming. Representative Smith, if you could just walk us through the bill, and we will take amendments as they come. Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, thank you.
I have with me Mr. Larry Martin of our Pension Commission staff. Members, this you'll have before you tonight two pension bills. This is Omnibus Pension Bill number one and Omnibus Pension Bill number two. This is number one. It is not the so-called teacher fix. It is the hopefully... Can you hear me? Are you on?
You're on.
Can you hear? This is Omnibus Pension Bill number one, members. It is not the teacher fix bill. It is the necessary pension fixes and items that have gone through the Pension Commission. And basically, you will. I'm going to ask Mr. Martin to give you a little bit more detailed article description, hopefully very brief. But the bill addresses changes to contribution rates for the Minnesota State Retirement System. Limits the augmentation rates for deferred retirements. There's many recodifications and technical changes throughout, and then a number of several single-person bills. With that, I'm going to ask Mr. Martin. At this time, Mr. Chairman, are there any specific questions that we could perhaps focus on rather than give you a word-by-word description of this bill?
Representative Kelleher.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much, and thank you, Representative Smith, for carrying the bill and all of your work on pensions. I really appreciate it. Members, I hope you'll indulge me at least for a few minutes tonight. I don't know if you want to do this right now, Representative, Mr. Chair. There was a section taken out in rules, and it's actually in the House Research Summary. So if you look on page 9 of that summary, which was dated, I think, April 24th, Article 9 was what is known as the MIRF provision. Mr. Chair, because, as you know, we don't take testimony in rules usually, I would appreciate if we could have some very brief testimony from the City Finance Director of Minneapolis about this particular provision tonight. I am not offering an amendment in this committee, but I need members to understand what is not in the bill so that in case at some point at the end of negotiations here this provision reappears, we can clear up any questions about it.
Representative Smith, are you okay allowing some brief testimony on that provision? That was the Sligo Amendment this morning in rules.
Mr. Chairman, I think it would be appropriate, and I think it would also be highly productive and maybe a little more better use of our time if we simply take the questions and you have your testimony or responses from Mr. Martin to any questions.
Okay, we will we'll allow Representative Kelleher to bring her witness up. Does anyone have other questions they'd like answered before we get to that provision? Okay, seeing none, Representative Kelleher, do you have your witness available tonight?
Yes, I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think Mr. Pat Bourne will be coming to the table, who is the Finance Director for the City of Minneapolis.
Bourne, welcome. If you could identify yourself, your position, and proceed.
I will. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for hearing my testimony. What I'm going to say, I'm Pat Bourne. I'm the Chief Financial Officer for the City of Minneapolis. My testimony is similar to testimony that we've previously given to the Pension Commission as well as other legislative committees. So if I'm repeating myself in front of any members, I apologize. But this provision is something Minneapolis has sponsored. In the purpose of the provision that's not in the bill right now is to restore the city and state contributions to MRF that were originally established when MRF was closed to new members back in 1978. I was certainly not around at the time, and I don't expect too many members were to recall this, but this provision does restore that relationship. It also maintains the full funding date of 2020 by which MRF will be fully funded. Those provisions are not changed. It simply allows the post-retirement fund at MRF to, in effect, borrow money from the pre-retirement fund and establish a payment plan that effectively restores the state and the city's contributions. During the past 5 years, the city has contributed under the present arrangement a total of $88 million to MRF under our present mechanism. The state's contribution has been about a third of that, a little less than a third of that, $26 million. I want to also mention to members that MRF is an extremely well-managed fund. It has the lowest expense ratio of any public fund in Minnesota. The city has conducted a number of overviews and oversights of all three of the closed pension funds that we have and have found MERF to be exceptionally well managed.
Oh, I took it out of there.
The provision that we would like to see here simply, as I mentioned before, simply restores this funding arrangement that was established back in 1978 and allows the city and the state to continue funding MERF at the level at which we think that it had been intended all along, and maintains MERF's target of being fully funded by 2020. I'd be happy to answer any questions from the committee.
Mr. Chair.
Questions for Mr. Bourne, or Representative Kelleher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I want to establish for the record, in case this comes up at some point in further negotiations, either on the pension bill or in some other way, that Mr. Bourne testified that this is a very well-managed fund. I believe that maybe you could address that a little further, Mr. Bourne, because there was sort of a accusation in the Rules Committee that it wasn't one of the well-managed funds, and there's concern about this particular procedure, but as I understand it, this is a must, or maybe you could tell us what the consequences of not having this provision in the bill are.
Certainly. Bourne, just a couple more notes about management. Over the past 8 to 10 years, the rate of return on investments in this fund have not exactly matched, but are proximate to the rate of returns on the State Board of Investment. The asset allocation in this fund is very similar to the asset allocation of the Board of Investment, and therefore rates of return are similar as well. As I mentioned, the expense ratio and the expenses to run this fund are comparable, if not less than, the expenses to run the other statewide plans, PARA, TRA, and MSRS. It may be said that 20 or 25 years ago, this fund was not well managed, and there were certainly well-known mispractices and bad practices that went on in this fund, but the last 8 to 10 years of this fund have shown very good management, and we expect that to continue. But what happened if the provision was not added back is that the fund will be fully funded when the last member is finally retired, and that's expected to occur well before 2020. The effect of the provision that exists today that we would like to change in effect causes the city to prepay the state's contributions, and that's why the city has contributed $88 million over the last 5 years, and the state has only contributed $26 million. This was clearly not the intent that appears to be the legislature's intent in 1978 when the fund was closed to new members, and the negotiation between the state and the city established how the fund would be fully funded over the remaining 30 years.
Representative Kelleher.
Mr. Chair, I'm not going to take a lot more time with this. Mr. Bourne, thank you for coming up today. If other members have questions, that's well and good. I just want to have members of this committee hear this testimony. I think many of you have the possibility of playing a key role in the end of session negotiations around this issue. I've carried the bill for 2 years now. It's made it through the Pension Commission. It's a very needed thing. And I'm out-trumped in the author of the amendment by a long ways, so I have decided that doing an amendment here in this committee is not really a wise idea, but I think members need to have a little bit of information. I'm sure Mr. Bourne would make himself available to anyone who needs further information about this provision or details of the fund. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Abrams.
Chairman, Mr. Bourne. What does the state pay now? And if the language in Article 9 was adopted, what would the state pay then? For how long?
Mr. Boyd.
The state currently is capped at, its contribution is capped at $9.1 million per year. That contribution varies according to a variety of factors, but it has varied between $7 and $9 million. That contribution would end as soon as the last person was retired, as would the city's contribution end as soon as the last person was retired under present law. If the amendment that the city has sponsored, that Representative Kelleher has carried, is adopted, the state's contribution would continue through 2020, as would the city's contribution through 2020. And it, again, it is capped annually at $9.1 million.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Abrams.
What happens now when the last person retires if there's a deficiency in the fund? And what happens if the language in the deleted Article 9, who pays a deficiency if the language in Article 9 is restored?
Mr. Bourne.
Mr. Chair, members, my understanding is that the post-retirement fund for MRF is not the responsibility, or the funding level of the post-retirement obligations, that is, after the last person is retired, is the obligation of that fund. There is no guarantee by either the city nor the state to make up deficiencies in the post-retirement fund. Those would have to be dealt with by members of MRF, and to the extent they felt they needed to come back to the legislature for any help, they would do that. But under present law, the post-retirement fund is the sole source of making pension payments to retirees.
Representative Abrams.
You know, I'm trying to understand, Representative Kelleher. I'm making every effort to understand, but, you know, Mr. Bourne, what I think you said, and, you know, I stand to be corrected, is that the state's $9.1 million obligation expires with the last retiree, which is going to occur before 2020, and that if there's a deficiency in the fund, it is the retirees who are going to bear the risk. And under Article 9, the state is going to assume more of an obligation to 2020, but still the post fund itself would, or the MRF would be responsible for any post-retirement fund deficiencies. If I'm correct in that, why, you know, I listened to the speaker and I didn't, you know, he was reading off of the sheet and I've never seen the sheet. Why is this a good deal for the state? And somehow, in the back of my mind, I think that there's some property tax implication for Minneapolis that they would be absolved of. Maybe you can help me with that piece too, Mr. Bourne.
Sure.
Mr. Bourne.
Mr. Chair, members, and to answer Representative Abrams' question, as best as I'm able anyway, it is true that both the state's contribution and the city's contribution would end under present law when the last person is retired. And that's true. However, between now and then, the city will pay more than we were expected to pay under the original funding plan adopted in 1978. I'm not going to tell you that the provision that the city seeks will cause the state to pay less money over the remaining period of time than it would otherwise. It probably will pay more money, but I can also tell you that during the last 5 years, the city has paid more than the state has paid, and it has relieved the state of making certain payment obligations that the city believes were originally intended to be the state. So, over the last 5 years, the state has gotten a good deal, and the city has ended up, in fact, having to issue bonds because the payment obligations to MRF have been so large that our ability to pay them out of our current operating budget, even with a substantial property tax increase annually, has just been impossible. So what we're seeking here is to redress what we think was an unintended consequence of a provision that was adopted in 1991 that caused the city to basically step in the event we had the kind of retirement patterns that occurred in 2000, 2001, 2002, and 2003, when more of our employees retired than we anticipated. When that happens under the current law, the city ends up making much larger payments to MRF, thus the $88 million that we paid and only the $26 million that the state has paid. And if that trend continues, the city will end up, in effect, paying what we believe the state a disproportionate amount compared to the relationship that was established in 1978. So if we look really at the 2000 to 2020 period, comparing what it would be under present law versus under the proposal that we have, I'm not prepared to say that the I just don't know whether the state will end up paying more or the city will end up paying more. It may wash out between the two of us. But we are simply seeking to have not the last 5 years change, but the next 13 or 14 years change, so that we're restoring this relationship between the state and the city.
Well, there's Kevin, one final question, and Mr. Bourne, you keep on using the word intent, and we can only go by what's in statute. Is there any coterminous writings or memoranda or other documentation that the statute as drafted did not meet the intent of the framers at the time?
Mr. Bourne?
Mr. Chairman, members, I could only turn to Mr. Martin to answer that. I'm not that familiar with legislative history, other than to have talked to other people about what that legislative history was.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
Representative Abrams,
I'll be very happy to chat offline with Representative Kelleher and representatives of the City of Minneapolis on this, but it's almost like looking at two sides of a coin, Representative Kelleher. And it depends upon what side of the coin you're looking at, if it's a good deal or a bad deal. And, you know, I can understand, he was speaking so fast and he was using a piece of paper that I've never seen. So I'm kind of trying to reconstruct it in my mind. But it does appear that the state, at least under the plain meaning, at least under the meaning of the current statute, will be paying millions of dollars more than they're currently obligated to pay. But there is some intent, and then there's also some fairness issues, because as I understand the law, and you can correct me, Mr. Bourne, when I really screw up the law, we'll only have 16 people in one court and another 7 in another to reverse me in the future. So you can reverse me right now. That every year you have to make good the deficiency. You can either do it through property taxes or you have some bonding capacity under the statute. You've chosen the bonding capacity under the statute, but kind of a discussion we had on the floor today is that your ability to float the pension bond paper is far greater than your ability to be able to raise the revenues in order to be able to defease the revenue, the pension bonds, is I think what I'm hearing you say. That's kind of the story.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, certainly over the last 5 years, the contributions the city has made have been so large and so much larger than we have historically made for MRF that we chose to issue bonds to spread those payments out over a longer period of time and not cause the property tax increases to be any higher than they were already planned to be. So I would also say that if this provision is not added back, we certainly do expect to issue more bonds simply because our capacity to meet this financial obligation annually is going to be so large that I just can't imagine that we'll either cut other spending to make room for it or to increase property taxes more than we already have, which is a substantial amount.
Mr. Bourne, has there ever been a discussion about not giving out such large pensions, or has that just been absent from the discussion in the last 20 years?
Mr. Chair, the pension payments made to these employees is very similar to the pensions that are paid to other municipal employees. There's a high five, similar kind of percentage of high five that represents the pension benefit of these employees. It's not substantially different. The difference in MRF, though, is that these employees can retire not under the rule of 90, but on 29 years and a day of service to the city of Minneapolis. These folks are also not eligible for Social Security under their city service. In that respect, these are not more generous pensions than what other municipal employees receive in Minnesota.
Mr. Bourne, what you're telling me is if someone starts working for the city of Minneapolis when they're 21 years old and get out of community college, when they're 50, they retire.
They would certainly be, yes, Mr. Chairman, that's true. They would be eligible.
That's what every municipal employee in Minnesota on average is doing?
No, my testimony, in fact, made that statement that except for the fact that these folks can retire with 29 years and a day of service, it is, in other respects, it is similar. That is, they have the high five against a very similar percentage of their high five salary that represents their pension benefit, plus you would also have to consider the fact that these folks are not coordinated with Social Security. They don't receive Social Security benefits either. And that would certainly have to be taken into consideration when you would make a judgment whether these folks are getting a richer pension benefit than other municipal employees do.
So if someone was making, say, $50,000 roughly their last 5 years of service and you were 49 and a half, what kind of pension would they get if they were on an average situation?
I
have no idea.
I'm not familiar with the percentage of what that $50,000 it would be.
Just trying to think of someone in the private sector that gets this, but maybe I'm, you know.
But the percentage, Chair, the percentage is similar to that which other municipal employees receive.
Yeah, I had Representative Bradley some time ago. Did Representative Abrams cover your area? Okay. Anybody else before we move on? Yeah. We do need to move on. Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Bourne, as I'm understanding, when you use the term that it's a very well-administered fund, benefits have nothing to do with that description of an administered fund. The benefits are aside, we're just looking at how the fund is managed. So a well-managed fund has nothing to do with the benefits that are being paid out in the descriptor of that. Is that correct?
Mr. Bourne.
Yes, that's correct.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Any further discussion on this item? Representative Kelleher.
I'm sorry, I know it's like paint drying to talk about these issues, but I appreciate members' attention. And Mr. Bourne, I think it does lead to the question, is every employee who's eligible under MRF retiring at 29 years plus one day, or what is the, you know, is there an average age of retirement, or could you give us an idea here? Is everyone retiring at 50 years old and going out somewhere? And just, I think it's important, no Social Security as well.
Mr. Chair, Representative Keller, certainly there are a few people that do retire at that first opportunity, but there certainly are a lot of folks who do not. In fact, two of the employees in my department who have worked for the city their entire career and have more than 40 years of service intend to fully work for the city for a very long period of time, even now. There are many of our employees who don't retire until they're well into their 60s. And in fact, park and library employees, especially library employees, have the tendency to work until they're well into their 70s. But people who work out in the field and are laborers due to injury or other kind of work-related factors do retire as soon as they can. They tend to get other jobs so that they are eligible for some Social Security benefits.
Thank you.
I have Representative Hamilton Bisgins. Representative Hamilton.
I think Representative Gunther answered my question. It may be a hayseed question, but I was wondering if the same entity is managing the Minneapolis pension funds today as they were to get us in this predicament, or has there been a change?
I think that might be a different bill that you're thinking about.
Oh,
you're thinking
it?
Teachers or MRF?
Has it well, I'm looking at all. I'm looking at a list here, so I'll hold. I'll wait.
Okay. Representative Bisgins?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Bourne, is there any withholding of benefits for a retiree who then takes another full-time job?
Mr. Bourne?
Mr. Chair, no, I don't believe so.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any further discussion on this item? Seeing none, we will move on to an amendment that we had, and then we'll move back to if anyone has questions. Representative Beard has the 3A amendment.
Thank you,
Representative Beard.
Mr. Chair, members, before we start, there is a little housekeeping we need to do. On line 1.3, where it says page 132, line 8, we need to make that say page 128, line 10. And on the next line, line 4, where it says article, whatever that said, 16, make it say 15. I think since we pulled that article 9 out this morning after the bill was printed, or after this amendment was drafted.
Beard incorporates those changes. 1.3 change 132 to 128, change 8 to 10, and in line 1.4 change 16 to 15. Representative Beard.
Thank you. Members, this is the bill, the amendment you've known over the years has become known as the pre-69 pension adjustment bill. This amendment addresses an inequity that was an unintended consequence created by legislative action in the early 1970s. Unfortunately, because the folks that it was done to had no idea that it was done, it did not manifest itself until after 1998, I believe. Now, I didn't come here until early 2003, but I hear that there's been attempts at legislative redress of this situation ever since then. What we have in this amendment, the 3A amendment, is the latest and last iteration of an attempt to acknowledge to this group of about 4,100 teachers, colloquially known as the pre-69 teachers, that indeed there was an unintended inequity created to them, and has a modest attempt at some sort of financial compensation for the loss that they incurred. What this is 25% of what normally would have happened, what their retirement funds would have been had the inequity not happened. They're asking for 25% of that number to come in a one-time 13th check once a year starting after July of 2007. Their projections are this will create an $83 million total increased liability to the TRA. They're proposing that it be financed with an appropriation of not more than $5 million a year from the general funds to make TRA whole after TRA issues the 13th check. On page 2 of the bill, if you wish to get into it a little further, subdivision 6, it describes the appropriation and how it works. Basically, it runs for up to 25 years. And I think, members, to bring some closure to this this request, I think a heartfelt and a fair request from about 4,100 teachers who had their pension plan changed without their knowledge or consent, I think this is about the most reasonable of the versions I've seen since I've been carrying this bill the last 4 years. One, it's a modest attempt. One I think we can vote on tonight and hopefully add to the Omnibus Pension Bill 1 as we move forward. With that, Mr. Chairman, if there are questions, I'd be happy to stand for them, even though I'm not a technician, did not actually draft this language. I'm just a happy carrier pigeon that's bringing it to this group tonight and asking for your consideration.
Any discussion on the 3A amendment? Representative Bisgins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Beard, can you give us a little history of this issue? Has this issue, I mean, it's been before us for as long as I've been here at the legislature, but has this always been a legislative issue, or was this issue brought before the courts? Have the courts ruled on this issue? Has there been appeals? Could you just fill in the committee on those particulars?
Mr. Representative Beard or Mr. Martin?
Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to take a stab at it, and I'm sure I'll be corrected by the TRA folks. But as I understand it, yes, Representative Biskins, there was a court challenge when this first popped up in 1998 because of the nature of what was done. It was not apparent to the people getting the pensions until then. They did launch a court challenge. The court ruled that the statute of limitations has expired and there was no court remedy. It was a legislative remedy. So since 1999, I believe there have been various legislative remedies proposed. I believe the original class included nearly 30,000 or in excess of 20,000 teachers who were retired or working that were affected by some things that were going on in the early 70s when the TRA was being tweaked, I think, refined. I think the whole concept of the teacher retirement account association was going through a little evolutionary process. I think that it became apparent that there were some people in that original legislative class who had actually made poor choices, for lack of a better word, and were irritated that their return wasn't as good as it could have been. If that was the case, members, I would not be carrying this bill. What we have here in the remaining 4,100 what we know as the Free 69 teachers, are that it's been winnowed down to the point that where these are the people who actually did try to act responsibly, make their choice, and were happy to live with it, but had the Legislative Pension Commission unilaterally actually change their choice without their knowledge, consent, and again, and change in such a way that it didn't appear unto them until after 1998. So, yes, there was a court challenge. Yes, it was thrown out because of statute of limitations. And, yes, this has been before us ever since.
Representative Biskins.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Beard, one final question. Mm-hmm. Does the TRA support this amendment?
Representative Beard.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Biskins and members, I would not imagine that they do or don't. I know that they have strong opinions about how much it's going to cost, how they're going to fund it, and I suppose TRA can speak for themselves.
Okay. Representative Rupavina, do you have anything on this? Or?
No.
Okay. Any further discussion on the 3A amendment? Representative Abrams.
Is there anybody here from Education Minnesota who may wish to testify amendments so that I can get a little bit more guidance?
Mr. Chairman.
I'm not sure that they wish to testify.
Oh, well, maybe Representative Smith can testify.
Representative Smith?
Mr. Chairman, I'd ask this witness to give a brief summary and maybe do a little correction of what we've just heard. Would you go right ahead?
Welcome to the committee, Luther.
Luther Thompson, representing TRA. We've looked at this. The first figure I heard was in the neighborhood of 80-some million. 25% of the difference is $115 million. That's the present value difference that they're asking for today. So that's the first thing. And we've estimated, the actuaries haven't had a chance to look at this new proposal, but Pension Commission staff and our staff have estimated it's probably between $5 and $6 million a year. So the $5 million probably wouldn't cover what they're estimating. TRA's board's position on this has consistently been that they oppose any benefit proposal that doesn't have adequate funding, and any sufficiency that TRA had would be used for a benefit improvement for all of our teachers. So if the state feels that they wronged this group of teachers and wishes to allocate the $115 million today, pay TRA over the next 25 years at least $5 million, that's your choice. But TRA would object to paying out anything over the appropriation that's given to TRA. As has been specified, this went to the Supreme Court, thrown out on the statute of limitations. The merits from either TRA's position or from the plaintiff's position has never been decided. So the issue of whether it's fair or unfair, the court never did address.
Representative Holberg, Mr. Chair, Mr. Thompson, on page 2 of the appropriations, you will see that it says that if the necessary appropriation amount is exceeds the amount that's then it's reduced, so the legislature isn't causing you to spend $6 million and only appropriating $5 million.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Solberg, I agree with your reading of that. Most people do, but I have talked to two of the people who have worked on this and represented it, and one of them's position was is that if in fact it cost $6 million a year and we only got $5 million, we would still pay that out, but somehow over the 25 years, because of the life experiences of these, we would somehow get it back. Well, if we pay out $3 million, if that's the cost, and we get $3 million, TRA is held harmless, without speaking about the merits.
Representative Solberg.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think I would read it like you would read it, and I think that's pretty clear. That's a pretty clear language. I suppose someone can read it some other way, but. It says what it says.
Okay, any further discussion on the amendment? Representative Beard will give you the last word.
Thank you, and I'm glad that Mr. Martin brought this up, because, Mr. Chairman and members, this actually is capped, you'll see in the last paragraph, paragraph C, capped at $5 million a year from the general fund, if that's as much as TRA needs to make the payments, and $5 million, if they need more than that, they are to actually prorate the benefit among the members who qualify so that they spend up to the $5 million and not a nickel more. That's the intent of the legislation as I understand it. And members, I've carried this for 4 years. I'd ask for your support in amending it into this bill, and we'll see if we can't redress this grievance. And thank you.
On the 3A amendment, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay.
No.
If any of the chair, the nays have it, the amendment's not adopted. The bill represents Smith's. Do we have further discussion on the bill? Any further discussion? Representative Smith renews his motion that House File 2239 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the General Register. Any further discussion? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay.
No.
The bill is passed. Representative Smith. Next bill on the docket is Senate File 1057. Representative Osmond, if you would come forward. Representative Osmond, were you going to have Representative Thiessen co-present with you this evening?
Yes, sir.
Representative Thiessen, are you available to come down? Representative Osmond moves that Senate File 1057 be recommended to pass, be referred to the General Register. And we are not sure that we have copies of this one. They're being handed out right now, members. Representative Osmond and Thiessen, whoever wants to go first, if you could walk through the bill orally while the copies are being handed out. Representative Osmond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 1057 is actually the language from House File 2847, which has been working its way through the process of the language that we essentially have here is identical to what passed out of the State Government Finance Committee with some technical changes, along with some additional provisions that we put in Rules Committee today. Those provisions would include language from the State Government Finance Bill that the State Board of Investment needs to allow them to cover their costs in a more flexible manner, and we believe that's non-controversial. And there's also language requiring the state and local units of government to list pension obligations as a separate line item in their budgets. The local units of government tell us that they can make this work, and they neither oppose nor support the provision but want the overall bill to pass. This is a suggestion of the Minnesota Taxpayers Association study and suggested by the Minnesota Realtors, and I believe that we have some significant agreement among legislators on this issue. The language also is requiring the state auditor to do some benchmark performance audits. The auditor already does this, but it would put the retirement of this requirement in statute. This is also a suggestion of the Minnesota Taxpayers Association. As you recall, they had a report on pensions about towards the first part of the month. That received some media publicity. This is also a provision that was supported by Minnesota Realtors, who was very active in that pension report. The language is requiring also requires the Pension Commission to do two studies by February 1st of 07. The first study would examine whether it makes sense to continue with basic fund post structure in the statewide funds, and the second study would examine the best structure for post-retirement investment bonuses, as well as how Minnesota benefits overall compared to other states within our teacher funds. The statewide funds have
we believe have are in agreement on this. We have good support from TRA and Education Minnesota, and feel that this is something that we can really provide. We, in order to resolve the biggest issue that we were addressing, and that is that the Minneapolis Teachers Retirement Fund is in some financial straits, and this will actually merge these two programs together, where the Minneapolis Teachers Retirement Fund will come into the Teachers Retirement Association, and that this will they will no longer Minneapolis program will no longer exist. It will become part of the state TRA. We have some reform in the bill with regard to pensions and providing for some caps with regard to some of the benefits that would be out there in the future. It's one of the criticisms that we've heard in the past about pensions is that in good times they seem to spend a little more than what they should, and that has lasting impact on the fund when the times are not so good. So we've tried to address those issues, and we appreciate the fact that if we were not doing this bill, if we need to come up with taxpayer dollars just to deal with this issue overall, it would cost us about double the amount that we're proposing in order to be able to deal with this issue through the assistance of TRA sufficiency funds. And I appreciate your support. And maybe Representative Thiessen has some additional comments.
The only thing that I would ask is there's one change that one small amendment we'd like to make on page 63, line 14. There's a sunset in there that was related to an earlier provision. If we could just delete that line, and someone could make that motion.
So move it, sir.
Representative Osment moves the oral amendment. What is it to delete section one? Delete line 63.14 on page 63. Any discussion to that amendment? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those say nay. The amendment is adopted. Any questions on the bill before we take amendments? Any other amendments? Okay, seeing none, I do have a 10A amendment that has been handed out. Would someone like to take credit for this?
Where is it?
Members, they have the 10A amendment. It was in the white chair, that packet.
That is mine.
Okay, Representative Paymar, do you have a copy or do members have a copy?
I do now.
Members, do you have copies? Okay, Representative Paymar offers the 10A amendment. Representative Paymar.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, this little history about the how St. Paul teachers got included into this bill. In the House State Government Finance Committee, the committee voted, Representative Seifert, I think it was your motion to include the St. Paul Teachers Retirement Fund retirees into the 5% cap. And the concern by the fund and the board of the fund is that this was not a recommendation that came out of the St. Paul Teachers Retirement Fund. It had no debate in the Pension Commission. It simply was put on a State Government Finance Committee. And there's concerns that the St. Paul Teachers Retirement Fund has about the potential implications with IRS rules if the St. Paul piece it remains in this pension bill. This is a complicated issue, and this is not an area that I have a tremendous amount of expertise on, but I know that the representatives from the St. Paul Teachers Retirement Fund have a resolution that they think is workable for the fund that will actually save the St. Paul Teachers Fund Retirement Association money in the long run, that will be fair to members as well as taxpayers of the city of St. Paul. So, Mr. Chair, if I could ask Mr. Phil Kapler, who is the president of the St. Paul Teachers Retirement Fund Association, as well as Michael Rice, to at least talk about their proposal and hope that you would give it some consideration.
I think that's very clear, Representative Paymar, and we will have witnesses. If we could have the witnesses just identify themselves and give some brief testimony.
Mr. Chairman and members, Kappler, Executive Director of the St. Paul Teachers Retirement Fund Association, and I have with me Brian Rice with the law firm Rice, Michaels & Johnson, who also represents us on numerous issues before the legislature. St. Paul's issue with this is this proposal was brought, the proposal that we've been brought under was brought by the state plans and the State Board of Investment, and their goal is to cap off increases so that they can accelerate the refunding of their post-retirement fund, because they, just like us, got beat up in the markets in 2000, 2001, 2002, and that's their objective here.
Yeah.
Part of the problems that these plans have faced in the past is, you give away investment gains in the good years and in the bad years. If there isn't a mechanism there to recover that, it can create a hole. Our board is not opposed conceptually to the idea of doing a caps on post-retirement increases. And in fact, I think that sometime soon would be a good opportunity to do just that, while the members are not used to seeing large compounding increases that, frankly, the fund can't sustain. St. Paul's position was, is we're in favor of the state plans going forward, if that's what they want to do. We have been advised by our legal counsel that this provision, putting a cap on our post-retirement increase, takes us outside of a grandfathering rule protection that the IRS created for plans that have two components to their increase. And in Minnesota, we have, for most plans, and with St. Paul, we have the same thing. We have a cost of living adjustment, and ours is a guaranteed 2%, and then an excess investment performance increase for excess investment earnings over 8.5% on a rolling five-year basis. It's that two-component piece that's a problem. The IRS rules, as they're written right now, don't really allow that, and that's the complication. If you go outside of, if you modify your plan at all, you go outside of that grandfathering protection, and you're not in conformance with the rule. Now, the state plans are planning to go back and seek an exemption or a private letter ruling, I think, from the IRS. I don't want to speak to their plans or their intentions or what they think their prospects are. Our board, on the basis of legal counsel's advice, does not think that this is a prudent thing for us to be doing. We requested in Pension Commission that St. Paul not be included in this bill. The Pension Commission honored that request and didn't put us in. Now, subsequently, we were put in because I think Representative Seifert saw it as a fairness and equity thing and something that we should apply to all plans if we possibly can. We respectfully disagree. We do respect Representative Seifert's and the legislature's intentions to cap cost of living adjustments for retirees. And so what we've come back with in this amendment is a proposal that does that. It caps increases at 5%. But it does so in a way that we think is in conformity, well, we know is in conformity with IRS rules as they now stand, and we won't need a private letter ruling for this particular increase. We would give CPIW the same way that Social Security does, because we've got a program that's coordinated with Social Security. So we would give CPI exactly as Social Security calculates it, up to 5%, so that we would respect that cap. That would synchronize us with the program that our retirement plan is coordinated with. It would put excess investment earnings back into the fund to help reduce our unfunded liabilities and to hold down contribution increases and lower the cost of this plan to taxpayers. There's another component to this which includes a rolling 30-year amortization of our unfunded liabilities. The effect of that, and it doesn't change your unfunded liabilities one iota. All it does is sort of reestablish the term of your mortgage. And anytime you make a structural plan for your benefit provisions or significant assumption changes for your plan that affect costs, it's a general practice that you move to a new amortization schedule. We believe, and it's a GASB-approved method, that going to a rolling amortization schedule of 30 years puts the elimination of unfunded liabilities on a schedule that is in sync with sort of full career cycle of an employee and fairly distributes the cost of paying off those unfunded liabilities evenly over cohorts of taxpayers and employees who are going to come into the plan over that cycle. And that's the second piece of this proposal. It's not as high a priority as the cost of living adjustment fix that we're proposing here. We think it's fair. We think it's equitable. It's a solution that respects the 5% cap. It puts excess earnings back into the fund, and it gets us in compliance with the IRS on day one, which is something that we think is important. It will result in lower cost of living adjustments for our retirees immediately, because this language proposes implementation on January 1, of 2007. So increases that this January could have been in the neighborhood of 4.5%, perhaps higher. Our board and members are willing to take a lower amount and match CPI. If we knock off a bad year and have a year anything like we've had on investment returns this year again, we could be in the 7-8% next time around. And frankly, it's not necessary to keep our members' benefits from deteriorating in their purchasing power, and our board feels that way, and our membership does too.
Mr. Chairman, if I could briefly, Brian Wright, I'm with Bryce Michelson Walter, and I represent the Committee of Nine. The Committee of Nine is the retired members, active members component of the St. Paul Teachers Retirement Fund Association. Just really 3 points. These funds have to respect your laws. They also have to respect the federal government's laws, Internal Revenue regulations. Their legal counsel, Oppenheimer Firm in St. Paul, believes that what's being proposed in the Seifert Amendment does not bring us in conformity with the federal law. This amendment would. This amendment would go in a direction, actually, that the Taxpayers Association recommended, that they're saying get rid of post-retirement increases based on investment and time to cost of living. That's what this does. We think the CPI is a reasonable approach, one that makes more sense. It was an idea that had it been adopted in the early 80s, you probably wouldn't have some of the funding problems you have now. But at that time, the state wasn't willing to look to do that because they were in a period of hyperinflation. We think a 3.3% increase would, which is what CPI has been the last 20 years, would be a fair one. It would be an inflation-protected one. It moves away from investment gains, which is a big concern that was raised by the current post-fund formula. And thirdly, I think this is important for the committee to hear. This is a proposal from a pension fund to reduce members' benefits within the next 6 months. And that may strike all of you as quite a shock. I know it struck Representative Pimar as a shock as we were explaining it. Why would a pension fund do it? Well, a pension fund has an obligation as a fiduciary to their members and to their taxpayers. The St. Paul Teachers Retirement Fund, which is composed of active members, retired members, and school district administrators, voted to do this. They think it is a wise course. It's going to result in their members in the next couple years receiving less than they otherwise would under the current language. It's an issue that I guess we had hoped we wouldn't be here at the table, because in deference to Minneapolis, we know this is a major issue. In deference to Representative Osmond, Representative Thiessen, this other bill has been many years in the making, but we got brought into this discussion. We feel it's important to bring it forward to the legislature. And honestly, as fiduciaries, we think it's the responsible thing to do. It keeps us in compliance with the federal laws. It is reform. It's very significant reform, and we hope the committee would support its inclusion in this bill.
Thank you very much. Is Mr. Burek or Mr. Martin able to come up and just answer a couple questions? We have an analysis that was done by Mr. Burek. Mr. Martin, what are long-term implications of adopting this amendment versus current law? As you know it, I don't know how much actuarial work has been done, but more cost, less cost, 2% versus CPI. Can you give us some thoughts from the nonpartisan pension commission staff point of view?
Mr. Chairman, members, yes, I can provide some help. I'm not Ed Burek. I'm Larry Martin from the Pension Commission. Ed works for me. We do have some actuarial work that was provided by the pension fund, and I've looked at it briefly. There are a couple of things going on in the St. Paul teacher proposal. What they've told you about is the way that they want to do the post-retirement increases. What they spent less time telling you about is how they want to fund it, which is basically moving to a rolling 30-year amortization period. If you could redo your house mortgage on a rolling basis every year, you would never pay off your house mortgage. This is a very problematic way to fund the program. And the reason why the actuarial work produces what looks like an improvement in the actuarial condition of the St. Paul Teachers Plan is the impact of the rolling 30 that they're proposing. The way of doing post-retirement increases based on a consumer price index or some other comparable measure of inflation is not a bad way potentially to go. The purpose of doing post-retirement increases is to replace lost purchasing power. And investment performance is not a good measure, is no measure of lost purchasing power. An increase in the CPI is closer to being that. So there's probably no argument with what they're proposing. I would suggest to you that in the Senate File 1057 bill, as it came out of the Rules Committee, the Pension Commission is obligated to study this issue of what's the proper way to construct post-retirement increases for teacher retirement plans and other public pension plans. To do this in anticipation rather than after the commission has had a chance to take a look at the issue doesn't seem to be the most prudent way to go. So I would raise concerns about the timing of making this change. The amendment that was added to the Senate File 1057 or what became 1057, Mr. Chair, your amendment does not go into effect until 2010. So we're not talking about something that will impact this plan or cause problems in the near term. There is time to do this in a less hurried and a more judicious manner.
Mr. Martin, you had mentioned about how to pay for it. What if this goes on and we move forward, what would be the way to pay for it? The pension, the corpus goes backwards, it depends on earnings returns.
Well, Mr. Chair, if only the change in the post-retirement adjustment were made, the normal cost and the amortization contribution requirement of the plan would go up. This plan already has about a 7% deficiency in its current contributions, and that would either add to that a deficiency or require that members and employers make higher contributions to offset the increase in the funding costs of the plan. Without the amortization change, the amortization change makes it look like it is a more fiscally responsible change than it actually is.
Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Martin, you said it would be more judicious to work on this issue ahead of time rather than do it now. I'm wondering if you could comment along the same lines of the earlier Seifert amendment, which added in St. Paul in the first place. I'm learning more about that here. The Pension Commission did not support or recommend St. Paul being in there. It wasn't in. It sounds like Representative Osmond's earlier bill. And then, of course, we all remember when we voted on the Seifert amendment to add in St. Paul. But my question then, Mr. Martin, is if St. Paul were not in and the Pension Commission took its time and looked at that issue in totality, what would that do then to the bill that we have for Minneapolis? Would it be a neutral?
Mr. Martin.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the Seifert Amendment doesn't go into effect until 2010. Having it or not having it in the short term until 2010 doesn't really change the way benefits are paid, how the plan operates. This coincides with the 5% limit that's being placed on the statewide pension plans, which also goes into effect in 2010. It permits, if there is a legal issue, it permits that to be fully fleshed out before it becomes effective. So I'm not sure that it makes any real particular difference.
Representative Solberg, did you have a question?
Mr. Chairman, I'm a little questioning on witnesses have stated that there's going to be a legal challenge, and Mr. Martin used to kind of hinted that there's going to be a legal question as well. How does that get resolved with the IRS, and who pays for that legal question?
Martin. Mr. Chairman, Representative, the 2010 date for the change in the post-retirement fund that applies to the statewide plans was picked at the request of those pension funds to give them an opportunity to get a private letter ruling from the Internal Revenue Service. I assume that letter ruling, which the pension funds, the major pension funds, are requesting in any event, will shed light on this issue, whether or not St. Paul chose to get a private letter ruling also.
Well, Mr. Chairman, are we then shifting some of the cost of the state's obligation under that cost for that ruling under the St. Paul?
Ms. Martin.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, no, the three major funds are planning to seek the private letter ruling whether or not the St. Paul provision is in there. The Internal Revenue Code provision that St. Paul is contending causes a problem is the same provision that would apply to the three major statewide plans. So the issue is going to be raised with the federal government whether St. Paul participates or does not participate in that private letter request.
Mr. Martin, I think we talked about that in state government a little bit, that we're basically, if it's going to be revisited, it's going to be revisited with all of them or none of them, correct?
Mr. Chair, the whatever ruling we got from the federal government would presumably apply in all comparable factual settings, and since since the St. Paul Features current post-retirement mechanism is very similar in some ways to the post fund, the ruling will likely apply to all plans.
Further discussion on the PMR amendment or questions? And we do have, Representative PMR, there's a clerical change we need to make on page and line numbers because of the engrossment changes.
Okay.
Would you like us to do that now?
Yes, please.
Numbers on 1.3, instead of page 3, it would say page 4. On line 1.4, it would say page 64 rather than page 60. And line 29 rather than line 13. Representative PMR incorporates those changes into his amendment. Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We have two memos from the Commission on Pensions that were passed out here. And I don't know what, one dated May 17th, which I was looking at, and then another one dated May 15th that came floating in. Why do we have the one for May 15th, which seems to go to another amendment?
Members, if I could help somewhat, the commission staff was requested on two different occasions to draft two different versions of what became this amendment. And as we typically do, there's a cover memo for each piece of work that we do. So you're looking at two different requests. St. Paul Teachers slightly altered the amendment that they were looking at as of May 15th, and that is what generated the May 17th.
So the May 17th would be the correct one, Mr. Martin, correct?
Right.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Hurt. Another question?
Yes. Mr. Chairman and Mr. Martin, on discussion and analysis, first page on the memo, paragraph 1, it talks about, however, as detailed in later issues below, the lack of any sound proposal to cover the additional liabilities that we created and the resulting lack of consistent cost raises concern. Now, what additional liabilities are being created by the PMR amendment?
Mr. Martin.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative, what you're shifting from is this current system where the post-retirement increase is paid for from investment gains, investment performance in excess of 8.5%. You're shifting under the PMR amendment to a promise of paying the cost of living cap at 5%. And it's not being paid for, it's not tied to investment gains. It will be paid whenever the CPI changes. The function of that in the way that we value, we do actuarial valuations, the entry age normal cost method that's used to prepare the actuarial work is that instead of being paid for fortuitously by investment gains, as it currently is, it will be part of the regular benefits of benefit structure of the plan, will increase the normal cost of the plan, and will increase the actuarial accrued liability of the plan, because it is becoming a promise, not a contingent possibility.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Martin, what you're suggesting is there may be years when the CPI is increasing and investment earnings are down?
Yes, Representative, that would be
I'm
suggesting.
Can you tell me about this rolling 30-year procedure not used by any other plans with unfunded liabilities, Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Martin.
Members, Representative, the way that pension plans in Minnesota are currently funded is that there is an amortization target date. There is a date on which the plan is supposed to be fully funded. The actuary calculates what supplemental contribution is needed to pay off the unfunded accrued liability by that date. It's a set one day only, and for this plan, I believe it's 2020 at the moment. This would reset the amortization date every year and reset it 30 years hence. As a practical matter, even if this was being amortized, even if that calculation was done on a conservative basis, on a level dollar basis, this plan I would never amortize. It's unfunded. In addition, we calculate the amortization contribution as a level percentage of an increasing payroll. That has the tendency to balloon the amortization payments to the final years of the period, and that just makes the rolling 30 that much worse.
Mr. Chairman, and as a practical matter, are there periods in our economic history when inflation is rising and investment earnings are down?
Representative, yes, 1974 through 1978 or thereabouts, what was known as stagflation, where we had relatively high inflation and very modest investment returns.
Thank you.
Representative Sikora.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Martin, is there anything in the plan that in the event that we have a sudden recession like we had a few years ago and the stock market pretty much plunges and therefore the funds, of course, lose a lot of money, is there anything in here that would then cut back on the payments to people? Since the fund was going down, you would want to contract the payments, I would think, in order to preserve the principal of the fund. Is there anything in our pension funds that do that?
Mr. Martin.
No, Mr. Chairman, there is not. Under the current system, that does not occur. Benefits do not go down when the market takes a sudden drop. So there's nothing in the current system, St. Paul Teachers, or any of the other plans, and there would be nothing under this our revised plan if the Paymar Amendment were to be adopted. In fairness, there is also, if you went to the Paymar plan, when there are very significant investment returns, the pension plan would fully benefit, its funding ratio would fully benefit from those high returns, because they would not be immediately translated into post-retirement increases as they currently are.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr.
Martin, are there some pension plans that have something built in so that they can get a larger increase in the good years but, you know, get less in the bad years?
Mr. Chair, yes, my understanding is that the Wisconsin pension system does use a modified variable annuity where benefits can go down. Past increases can be recouped. The original version of the post-retirement increase mechanism that statewide plans use, one that was enacted by the legislature in 1969 and replaced in 1980, similarly would provided for a loss of past increases in the event of a market downturn. The force of events and whatever happened, that feature of a modified variable annuity was discarded in 1980.
One last
okay, I'll give the last word to... Okay, this is the last word to Representative Osmond and Paymar, the author of the bill and the author of the amendment. Representative Paymar, did you have anything else in the amendment? Then I'll let Representative Osmond, since he's the author of the bill, speak. Representative Amar.
No, I just would urge your approval. I think that the board has examined the issue carefully, and they're exercising their fiduciary responsibility on behalf of teachers as well as the school district, and I think that this is a reasonable plan. We wouldn't have had to have this discussion. We could have had it at the Pension Commission, had the Seifert Amendment not gone on originally. But since it is, I think that we should trust the board and they're coming up with a creative plan for its membership.
The author of the bill, Representative Osmond, and then we're going to vote.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. You see now why I'm so grateful that Representative Thiessen has helped me with this bill. As you listen to the complexities, their eyes can get rolling pretty quick. I do know, though, as I'm looking at this, that the provisions in the current bill do not have any immediate impact that are even in question. There's plenty of time to deal with those issues should they be of concern. Where I'm the advice that we're giving with regard to the amendment is that it could have some immediate impacts. In fact, the advice says that it could make the current provisions of St. Paul to where they'd be very difficult for us to even merge them in the future should they run into some financial difficulties. So trying to keep the bill as clean as possible and with non-controversial impacts, trying to pull everything together, I really strongly support a no vote on this amendment because I think it really is in our long-term best interest to keep the current package together.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, those in favor of the PMR amendment say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay.
No.
Opinion is here, the nays have it, the amendment is not adopted. Any discussion on the bill? Any discussion on the bill? Representative Osmond renews his motion that Senate File 1057 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the General Register as amended. Any discussion? Seeing none, those in favor say aye. Those opposed say nay. The bill is passed.
Yes, yes.
You're done?
No.
The next bill that we have, at least I have e-wasted a lot of my time on today out in the hallway, is Senate File 1298.
You missed 15 minutes.
You missed the
Representative Cox.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Really, members.
Representative Osmond moves that Senate File 1298 be recommended to pass and be referred to the General Register. Representative Cox, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Bill before you, Senate File 1298, has been worked on by a number of people for quite a while. I'm going to walk through a couple parts of it here for you, and then I know there's a number of people that want to testify. Mr. Chair, do you have a time limit on when you want to go? I've got at least one person that's come from St. Louis County and really needs to...
Representative Cox, we've tried to keep our testimony to just a few minutes. If
okay.
We could, you can bring your testifier down. We don't want to restrict anyone, particularly from such a long distance, but we also have other conference committees meeting. So,
okay.
Who is your testifier, Representative Cox?
Mr. Trulin, I'll run through the bill here real quickly and then turn it over to him. But
okay.
Members, in the bill before you, it's I'm going to call it a two-part bill. For those of you that followed any of this activity, last year we ended up with, we couldn't come to agreement on how to handle electronic waste here in Minnesota, and we pushed the ban back on the disposal of televisions, computer monitors, and so forth in landfills. That was to go into effect last year. We pushed it back a year and created a solid waste task force. That task force met several times over the fall, and for your knowledge, there the Senate senators on that task force were Senator Higgins, Chair Higgins, Bach, Fredrickson, McGinn, and Kubley, and representatives were chaired by Representative Osmond and Hackbarth, Cox, Thiessen, and Wagenius served on it. We met and worked and came up with task force language, and the task force language for that we developed is basically from on section 3 of the bill. And it's fairly prescriptive and deals with a number of things manufacturers must do, label products and register with the state, deals with retailers, it deals with collectors, recyclers. There's a registration fee. Manufacturers will end up registering with this revenue department. I should say creating an account with the revenue department. And there's a formula in there.
that where they report their sales and so forth, and it's a system of credits and shortages essentially that is created, so that the goal here was to have manufacturers recycle one unit for every one they sell. That's really what the bottom line here is. If you're selling one, you're recycling one. And if everything works properly, that's what the task force came away with, and we thought we had a pretty good bill. After we ended up, several weeks after we closed down the task force, manufacturers raised some concerns, and they have a significant issue, as it turns out, with reporting information. The task force tried to address this by having them report their sales and so forth to the revenue department, and I personally think that that's a fine way to do it, and I don't see the problems there, but they did. So they came forward with language that they would like to see the state use to handle electronic waste. That is Section 1 of your bill, and it has been referred to different things as a trust us method, whatever. There's not anywhere near the prescriptive teeth in this provision, but they do promise to recycle 9 million pounds of waste a year and so forth, and so there are some good things in that too. But without a way to make sure that that's happening, we were very concerned. So in the Environment Committee, we put the manufacturer's language in as Section 1. Section 2 is a trigger event. It measures and sees how they're doing. If they're doing well, it continues. If they're not doing well, then we go over and convert over to the task force language. So it's people have called it a hammer approach. I don't care what you want to call it. It's the bill before you has language that the manufacturers say that will work. We hope it will work. And there's a trigger to measure it. If that doesn't work, the task force language, which I am absolutely convinced will work, takes place. So with that, I would like to have a testifier that has come from a distance speak.
Sir, would you state your name, and then we'll begin listening to your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Ted Trulene. I'm the director of St. Louis County's Solid Waste Department. I'm also the immediate past president of the Minnesota Solid Waste Administrators Association, a statewide organization that represents all the counties in the state of solid waste, and of course we're members of AMC. Thank you very much. I understand that everyone's tired. I'll try to keep my comments very brief. I'm here representing counties. In many ways, I'm also representing the end of the pipe. We're where garbage ends up. We're the folks that end up having to manage it if there isn't anybody else that's going to manage it. We're urging you to support electronics legislation that helps us manage the waste, the televisions, computer monitors, other materials out there. I do want to say, though, that we support the original bill, the bill that was developed by the Solid Waste Task Force. I think the Senate and House members that got together, worked out that bill, had a very thoughtful, very deliberative process, and they brought in input from all the different stakeholders, and they came up with what we thought was a good bill. Since that time, the bill has been amended with what has been described as the Trust Us Amendment. From the perspective of counties, from the perspective of AMC, the solid waste administrators, we feel the time for a Trust Us Amendment is long since come and gone. At this point, we would support the passage of the original bill with the original requirements for the manufacturers to follow. We request that for several reasons. First of all, we're concerned that under the revised bill with the Trust Us provisions, there will be less incentives for manufacturers to actually come on out and help us. We see there is a trigger amount of waste of electronics they have to manage, but we don't believe it's an ambitious number at all. We're concerned that the costs of this bill will ultimately end up falling on local units of government and ultimately on the local taxpayers. We believe that manufacturers should play a role in working with local units of government and trying to solve this problem. And we're concerned that without a bill, without an ambitious bill, without the original task force bill, that we're going to see more illegal disposal, and we're going to have additional cleanup costs and additional problems. So my message to you tonight is I guess, a fairly blunt request that if you go back to the original bill as was developed by the Solid Waste Task Force. And with that, I'll wrap up and try to answer any questions you might have.
Okay, very good. Members, are there anyone that wants to ask a further representative?
We have a delete all amendment here, Mr. Cox. Is that has been offered, or what's why is that in our packet?
Representative, Mr. Chair, and Representative
Cox.
Yep. Thank you. The delete all amendment that is in your packet does contain some minor changes. You should have actually a delete all amendment that's 1714.
Yes.
And then do you also have an 831 amendment?
831, yeah.
Yeah. Those two together actually correct some minor changes and so forth that were discovered between the Environment Committee and this committee. So if you could go ahead and move those.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bradley.
I do want to respect, though, if there were any questions to the testifier, and then I would be happy to, when it's appropriate, I would move those amendments.
Representative Solberg.
Mr. Chairman, if we would adopt the amendment that's before us, so are you saying that that burden is going to fall on the counties?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Solberg.
Excuse me. Mr. Trulane, would you kindly go through the chair? Continue.
Mr. Chair, I apologize for
that's okay.
Being out of line. Mr. Chair, Representative Solberg, it's our belief that the bill as revised with the Trust Us Amendment won't really accomplish much more than is already being done under existing recycling efforts. We don't believe that it's... We're concerned that it doesn't set ambitious goals and doesn't provide any type of specific manufacturer responsibility to come on out and help us with our programs. And we believe that as a result, with the ban coming in July 1st, 2006, our residents are going to need some place to dispose of their materials. We're there. They'll be bringing them to our facilities, and we will end up ultimately having to set up and fund the program to manage those materials. So we believe that, yes, the ultimate costs will fall upon local units of government. And we're willing to pay part of our share, but we're hoping that it was always our belief that we could have a partnership with manufacturers and go at this collectively, and we don't see that happening.
Are there any other questions? Hearing?
I guess I didn't see it, Mr. Chair. Then, I would offer, first of all, the delete all amendment 806-1714, and to explain, I don't think this changes the description. This has some changes that are primarily just made in wording improvements, those kinds of things. I think that's correct. The decision to make it a delete all was just to make it a little bit more readable, but I don't think it changed at all the description that was made. Am I correct in it, Representative Cox?
Representative Cox.
Mr. Chair and Representative Bradley, that essentially is it. There were some minor changes on as they worked on this, but no, it's very, very close to the bill before you, so it is best probably to work off of the delete all.
Mr. Chair, in a sense, it's really an author's amendment to get the bill in a shape that should be proceeding with. So I'd offer that that amendment. And then, Mr. Chair, I believe because the A31 amendment actually modifies that delete all, then I would offer the A31 amendment, and I think that just makes some additional wording changes. And have some constant perhaps comment if there's anything more than that in the A31 amendment.
Representative Cox, is there any additional information that we need relative to the amendment?
Mr. Chair, thank you. The A31 amendment does make some clarifications. And one of the things it does is it moves a few things from the task force language forward into the manufacturers. As you see under definitions, we've got collector, recycler, retailer, and so forth, some of that. And then there's some spelling corrections on 1.18 that had covered electron, and we're dealing with electronics and so forth. So, no, that's pretty much it. There's agreements on that.
Okay, thank you very much. Any other questions? Seeing none.
Mr. Chair, excuse me, but if there's not an objection based on that description, then I might incorporate the A31 into the 1714 mm-hmm. amendment.
Okay. Representative Bradley then incorporates A31 amendment, and it's into 1714. Mm-hmm. Any questions? Oh, Representative.
Thank you. I just have a technical question on page 2. Did it delete all line 22? Were they about the selling the sale part? Did you mean new video display device? You talked about that later in the bill.
Representative Cox.
Excuse me, Representative Abler.
Well, on page 2, line 22,
mm-hmm.
it says in this state a video display that they're for sale. Do they mean new display? Because they use the word new later on.
Yes, that would be correct. This is
so for that need to be clarified. Later you say new video device.
Representative Cox, Mr. Chair, and Representative Abler, that on the requirement for sale, that whole subdivision is effectively dealing with sales and new sales is what we've got in here.
A little later you say, Mr. Chair, just later you talk about new videos. This talks about sales, but doesn't talk about used or new ones. Sales from a person to person. I just thought you meant about new stuff. Is that your intent?
Representative Cox.
Mr. Chair, we haven't really dealt with separating used or new on this. Most of this language does affect new sales because it's dealing with the manufacturers registering, and from that point forward, whoever's selling it, if it's a retail that needs to verify that it is a registered product and so forth, would apply to that. But once it's manufactured under this registration.
Representative Eagle, do you have any other questions?
It's fine for now.
Okay. Thank you. Then Representative Bradley moves that A061714 has incorporated be recommended to pass. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, same sign.
No.
Member, the members, the has passed.
That was amended.
And we now have the.
We have both of these on here now.
Yeah, it's all done.
We have the bill in its proper order, and
Mr. Chairman, I have an amendment.
And would you kindly state what is your amendment?
I have an amendment that is being passed out by staff right now. It's 8:30, and while it's being described, I'd be glad.
Okay.
While it's being handed out, I'd be glad to describe it.
Okay. Well, are we getting a copy of the?
Okay. Wait, Mr. Chair. I'm going to add humor to this.
Okay, Representative Wilgenius, would you kindly inform us relative to your amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I take Mr. Trulene's comments to heart, and this amendment simply deletes the trust, what he terms as the trust me amendment that went on to the task force proposal and takes us back to the task force proposal as it was originally done. So what you're seeing here is simply an amendment to move us back to the task force proposal. It's no more complicated than that. And I would want to mention or to highlight what Mr. Trulene talked about in terms of the burden that I believe we should not be putting on our counties financially and I have looked at the numbers a bit, members, and using a range of between 45 and 60 cents a pound for what it takes to collect and transport and then recycle waste, it is between 45 and 60 cents a pound. And if you were using what the counties have told us is the real issue out there, which is about 18 million pounds, that is $8 to $10 million a year that I don't think we want to burden our counties with at this point. So, members, that is the amendment. Pure and simple to go back to the task force bill.
Representative Gunther.
Chairman.
On the amendment.
Yeah, Representative Genius, without going through the whole bill, deleting and adding in, can you tell me what the difference between the Representative Cox proposal, the manufacturer's proposal, and the task force? Just a little kind of quick synopsis. What is the function of county government in both of them? What is the onus put on a person who buys a electronic device that is to be recycled, one program versus the other?
Representative Borginius.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think that actually comes better from someone like Mr. Trulene, who is on the ground working in this. I am not an on-the-ground working in this. What troubles me about the proposal that we got from the manufacturers, it has no direct provision in it that says who's responsible for the 9 million pounds. It just looks at that and says, if that is collected, by whom, it does not say. If that is collected, then everything is fine. And we don't have a specific way to get there, and that is a concern. So the task force proposal is very direct, and I think we had very good testimony, and of course I wish this committee had heard it. But I think Mr. Chulene is the best person here to tell us about it, if that would be all right, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chulene, can you answer that question for us?
Mr. Trulene?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Gunther, I can certainly try. As Representative Roginius mentioned, we have two bills. The one of them, the trust us provision, would essentially call upon the manufacturers to voluntarily, over the course of the next several years, come out and apparently work with local units of government to help do some of the recycling of these electronics. However, it's very unclear to us what the manufacturers would actually be required to do. I think it's important to note the manufacturer bill doesn't even start till 2008. Registration wouldn't start till 2007. Collection 2008. Well, the ban starts in July 1st, 2006. The ban starts in 5 weeks. So, and when that ban starts, our residents are going to need some place to take their materials, and that someplace will end up in Greater Minnesota being the county system. So we will have to establish and pay for a management system immediately to accept those materials. And as the TV switch over to high definition goes, we'll get more and more and more of them. I think too, it's one of the things we will need to do, or at least some counties will need to do, is decide how they're going to fund this. Currently, counties around the state have chosen a variety of different funding methods for how they fund collection. I know one county, the county my parents happen to live in, charges full cost. So in that county, in order to dispose of a 25-inch console TV, it costs about $110. And my parents live in that county, and there's no way my parents are going to pay $110 to get rid of a 25-inch console TV. That TV will become part of the estate, and their children will end up trying to figure out what to do with it someday. In other instances, counties are going to subsidize the disposal costs to generators so they don't end up in the ditches. I'm from St. Louis County. We're the biggest county east in Mississippi. We have lots of public roads. We have lots of opportunities for illegal disposal. Unless we subsidize the costs of disposal, unless we get help, we'll have to subsidize, and that subsidy will go on the back of taxpayers. So essentially, our concern is that without the original task force bill, we're going to end up with a disjointed system. Each county will have its own little system. Generators aren't going to know what exactly they're supposed to be doing. The net result will be a lot of confusion.
Okay, Representative Biskins, I believe you're next.
It helps a little bit.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I don't know if Representative Gunther's second part of this question got answered, and so I'll ask the second part of this question, all right? Absent the trust me provision, what does the bill do?
I can help with that.
Representative Cox.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Biskins, as I said at the beginning, the task force language was gone over fairly carefully with a number of meetings, and it essentially sets up a program where manufacturers and recyclers and collectors are going to register. And if you look on page 11 of the amendment now that before us, the 1714 amendment, you'll see there is a manufacturer's registration fee. So we have an account that will get, or a fees that will be received, and they'll be deposited in an account, Environment Fund account here. And then those funds will be used, if you look over on page 12, and they'll be distributed on a competitive basis on lines 12.30 and 31, competitive basis through contracts to handle the collection and proper disposal and recycling of the waste. That's probably the biggest difference between the bills, in that there is an established collection method that's going to raise some revenue, and it'll go out on a fairly organized basis. And I think that's why Mr. Julian here and other county people are supporting it. It's pretty clear that the counties are not going to be having be exposed to costs if you use this task force bill. It was fairly careful as it went through, and it also includes, on page 15, includes a report back to the governor and the legislature on how this is working, if there's some adjustments that need to be put into place with it. But it effectively, Representative Biskins, would be a program that would be operated on a competitive basis, and that may include counties, it may include private people, may include anybody that is competitive on it.
Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, yeah, I do. So, Mr. Chairman, Representative Cox, there's a big fee on the manufacturers. Okay, I get that. If the first part is not adopted, the fee starts immediately. All right. If that first part stays in the bill, all right, then the manufacturers have a chance to prove, before this fee is imposed upon them, the manufacturers have a chance to prove that, yes, indeed, they do want to work and be part of the solution. And if they don't, then this big fee provision kicks in. How do the manufacturers feel about the second part? If I could have you answer that, do they support the second part of the bill?
Representative Cox.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Biskins, again, as I said at the beginning, they have some real concerns with the second part. They also included fees on themselves, and, you know, to be fair, in their manufacturer's plan, if you look at the top of page 3, you'll see there they call for registrations of $5,000 fees, same amount, but they don't have all the other stuff. But they're saying they will take care, they basically will expose themselves to their fees by way of processing the waste, collecting it and processing it, is what they're saying.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Cox. And I've read the bill, and I know what the issue is. I guess what I'm trying to say here is that we have witness from the testimony, Mr. Tureen, who said that they'd like to work together with the manufacturers. It seems to me the bill as it's currently before us gives the opportunity to work together with the manufacturers. And if the manufacturers aren't holding up their end of the bargain, then there's going to be a process that they don't like. So it seems to me that they're incented in this bill to work with the counties to make sure this disposal gets taken care of. But what it sounds like that the counties want to do is say, well, no, let's
go right to what they don't like. We don't want to work together with the manufacturers. So I'm seeing a feeling a little disjoint here. I guess what I'm trying to say is I oppose the amendment.
Okay. Representative Wagenius.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it's a little rough to classify all manufacturers in one lump. I think we got a letter today from Best Buy, and I see they're here, and they said, let's go with the original task force, if I'm reading their letter correctly, and they're here, and they can correct me if I am wrong. And Representative Fiskins, I wish you were right, but I would have you look on page 2, and certainly Representative Gunther, too, look on page 2 at the very bottom, where it says lines 2.34, a manufacturer has the sole discretion to determine the scope, terms, and conditions of such a program. So the counties don't have that same opportunity. So it's a very different thing than Minnesota would ever have done with this particular language.
I have Representative Klinzing, Huntley, and Osment, and then I think we're fully informed. Representative Klinzing.
Thank you, and I think this goes to both the amendment and the whole bill because of the nature of the amendment. But my question is about the revenue note, the fiscal note we got that says it costs about 25 cents per pound on average to do hazardous waste recycling. And this is from the state. And yet, in the algebraic equation of the bill, the estimated price per pound of recycling is set at 50 cents a pound. And I just want to know why there's why in the bill the assumption is it's going to cost twice as much as it's currently costing the state to dispose of the hazardous waste.
Representative Cox.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Klinzing, we may want to get Art Dunn or Garth Eppel or somebody from PCA down here. But really, I think what this addresses, 20 to 25 cents is probably the actual recycling cost. We've got the transport and other things, the storage that are related to the total cost of the recycling of this material. And we tried to determine what that would be, a fair number as best the task force could. We had people talking about 40 to 60 cents in there, and 50 cents is kind of in the middle. But I'm sure we have some people in the room that could address that if you needed to.
Representative Klinzing, is it compelling that we bring someone in, or
well, sufficient? I think it's going to the we're bringing in extra money to do a program. We don't know what it's going to cost, and the actual cost right now, according to our fiscal note from the Department of Revenue, they're saying it costs half as much as what we're trying to collect in this fee, according to this algebraic equation in the bill. So, you know, I do think it's important as we go forward that we're not over-collecting for the cost.
Mr. Chair.
And because that is going to end up into the cost to the consumer. And, I think that this whole concept that, you know, your parents are going to have to get rid of their TV for $1,000, but if this passes, they won't have to pay that. That's actually incorrect. They will be paying it in the end.
To that point, Representative.
To that point, the consolidated fiscal note was completed on 4/12/06. But this version of the bill was not done until just a short time ago. So I think that the fiscal note relates, as I understand it, to the second part from, as Representative Cox stated, the section 3 on. Now, I might be reading that wrong, but it seems to me that the way this bill is drafted, there's no income to the state.
Mr. Marks, do you have an answer for us?
Mr. Chair, members, I believe the fiscal note, and Mr. Reinholz on the fiscal staff had some discussion with PCA about this, but I believe the numbers in the fiscal note essentially work for both parts of the bill. And that was his understanding. If Mr. Dunn's here, he could probably comment on that as well.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Cox.
If you've got the, and Representative Solberg, if you've got the front fiscal analyst department dated 5/17, that addresses that, and that Mr. Marks is exactly right. The information on it was assembled earlier, but as his note says, the attached fiscal note is accurate for either of the programs in regard to the total revenue and expenditures. It really, and members, I want to stress that I think the costs to the consumers are going to be the same on either one of these. You're either going to have manufacturers running the programs all by themselves, and we're really not going to have those numbers, Representative Flinty. I mean, we don't have them. They're running the programs. They're collecting this material. They're recycling it properly. Or in the other program, the task force language, there is an assigned amount, and then that would go to the PCA and get dispersed out of there, and we'll probably have a little better handle on whether that number is right or not after a year or two of operation. But either way, I think the costs of this are going to be incorporated into the product.
As I understand the first part of it, the manufacturer responsibility is to register, but it's a voluntary registration. Is that not?
Representative Cox.
Mr. Chair, Representative Solberg, I don't believe it would be voluntary in that if they want to sell product here, they have to register, and then they have a fee, that initial fee that they have to, and I think the fee, if I remember correctly, is the same in both halves, the $5,000 fee.
Mr. Chairman, can I order, or someone orders it from Dell, do they, since they're located in, I think it's Dell in South Dakota, do they have to register? Ship it in here?
Mm-hmm. Tax.
Mr. Chair and Representative Solberg, Internet sales, we wouldn't be able to get them to register, but if there are physical presences in the state, if Dell has a bricks-and-mortar building, then they're going to register.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I understand that. That's and the state law for sales tax as well, mm-hmm. the federal law. But there's an awful lot of... these are purchased over the internet without any kind of, and it's not just computers, it's all kinds of electronic stuff that's over the internet. And my understanding is that this registration and paying $5,000 is almost becomes a voluntary thing. There's no way to track it in the first part. I may be mistaken on that. But if I was, if the state came up to me and said, well, would you pay $5,000? Oh, by the way, it's voluntary. I know what I tell them.
Representative Cox.
Mr. Chair, I'm following you now, Representative Solberg, and in that standpoint, you probably can assume this is a voluntary basis. In the task force language, there's a better handle because of the reporting requirements that come along with that, and that is what the manufacturers objected to, and I'm sure they'll come to the table in a little bit.
Mr. Chairman, if the manufacturers have objected to it, then it's obviously that I think I had hit the nail on the head. But I don't want to spend very much time tonight.
Mr. Chair, and just one follow-up, and that's why the task force, I think wisely of Representative Osmond's suggestion, has all that reporting information in the task force language going to the Department of Revenue. As he used in an example, we all hopefully pay sales or income taxes in this room, but we don't know what each other pays. And it's the same deal with that. If the manufacturers report information to the revenue department, they'll get that information to the people that need it, but not to the people that don't need it.
Representative Huntley.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think Representative Biskins has got it just absolutely wrong. You know, I'm just a country boy from the North Woods, but when a large out-of-state corporation says, trust me, I usually try to get a good grip on my wallet. And, if you believe in free enterprise and smaller government, then you ought to vote for the Wagenius Amendment. If you believe that government should solve all the problems that happen in our society and we should hire more county employees to take care of this mess, then you should vote against the Wagenius Amendment. I just happen to think that we ought to let free enterprise fix this problem and solve it on their own. And force them to do that. I don't think we ought to hire more county employees to pick up the trash from these corporations from out of state that are shipping their dangerous products into our state. So vote for smaller government, vote for free enterprise, vote for the Wagenius Amendment.
Representative
Before we go on any further, for members of the committee here, and there are four of us on the conference committee on the budget, and there's people in the audience that plan on traipsing along with us across the street, it has been canceled for this evening. That's a good progress on our end of session, the way it sounds. I have Representative Osment.
Well, on that note, Mr.
Chair. So successful as this, though.
We may have all kinds of time to work on this stuff.
It's getting at 10 o'clock.
9:30.
I would like to have an opportunity just to kind of explain a little bit, because I understand from what Representative Huntley just mentioned, I'm sure that many of the colleagues on my side went, what? It's got to be a little bit different, but that's not really, he is right on target as to what's happening with this. The first part is like you say, it's kind of the manufacturers would pay a fee, and then they put together a plan and kind of tell us how they hope to work with counties and others across the state in order to pick up the recycling. What the task force provisions did is that we took off on that concept that we wanted to have the current system and the free enterprise system really supported in how we can address this issue. And so we came up with a concept of if you sell one, you should be responsible for recycling one. And so it's that's kind of the overall efforts of the bill. So if I could, you manufacture or you sell one, you're going to recycle one. That's a basic concept. Well, how does that conflict from what we had in front of us last year? Remember last year we had, we're going to divide up the waste issues and the cost based upon the pile of the trash. Whose trash was in the pile? Then there was going to be a big sort, and then as depending upon how it was sorted out, that's who was going to end up paying for the recycling efforts. Well, that really hammered IBM because they had a significant part of the trash, but they don't sell them in the market anymore. So we said, what we really need to do is try and figure out as to what is the share of the market. So shouldn't we put a cost at the point of sale? Well, we don't want to have the fees, advanced fees, accepted, because that brings in the retailers. And the retailers say, wait a minute, they shouldn't be tax collectors. They don't want to get involved in this. It should be a responsibility of somebody else. And so we couldn't figure out how do we get the information of who's selling what in the state of Minnesota to determine what their share should be with regard to helping us out with the recycling. Keep in mind, recycling is not going to happen on its own. It's not a profit-making business where you take something old and you recycle it, and all of a sudden you have actually made a profit. Not only paid for the recycling, but you made a profit. It's a fantasy. It doesn't exist. There is extra costs. One of the biggest ones is transportation. And so recognizing that we have costs, we need to collect money. People didn't want to go to an advanced recycling fee at the point of sale. So then we said, well, how about at the end of life? So when you go to recycle it, that's where you'll pay. Well, we have problems there because some people won't want to pay the dollar amount at that point because, as they pointed out, there could be significant costs at the point of where you're trying to recycle. And so they end up throwing them in a ditch. Well, then who picks up the cost? The taxpayers, the property taxpayers, are the ones that end up picking the cost up. So we said, that's not fair. So what can we do? Well, if you go back to the concept that you sell one, you should recycle one, then how do we actually get the manufacturers involved where they say, jeepers, it's in our interest to help out in the recycling effort. We should actually go to existing recyclers out there and see if we can't get a contract with them to try and collect these things and pay for and recycle them appropriately and environmentally correct, and yet we'll help with that overall cost. We'll cover that gap, you know. How do you do that? Well, the way it was done is that we had everyone, the proposal is that the manufacturers to sell in the state of Minnesota would pay a $5,000 fee just to start out the first year. Then we go back a year later, after they have their sales experience, and they would report to the Department of Revenue how much they actually sold in the state of Minnesota. Now, if they didn't want to reveal that information, we can go on national statistics. We can tell them about what their share probably is. So we could give them an estimate as to what their cost would be for their recycling efforts. So their new registration fee for the next year would be $5,000, plus 50 cents a pound for everything they had sold in the state of Minnesota. They didn't like our estimate. Remember, they could bring up their actual sales data. They go to the Department of Revenue to protect their proprietary information, because they said that's the reason they can't share with what they're going to sell, what they sold in the state of Minnesota, because that would let their competitors know. We said, okay, we'll let the Department of Revenue do it. Revenue has been involved with this whole thing. We've set up a process to protect that data. So what that does is that manufacturers then would actually have their registration fee adjusted every year based upon their sales from last year. So in other words, if you're selling products in the state of Minnesota, you'll actually help us out with the recycling efforts. You make those agreements with your local recyclers or others, or do it yourself if you want to. And we will then give you direct credit, one for one, on your fee for with regard to the poundage. So if you have recycled X number of pounds and you sold the same number of pounds, your fee is $5,000, period. There isn't anything additional. If you pay your $5,000 fee and you sell X number of pounds and you don't recycle anything, you'll pay 50 cents for every pound you sold in the state of Minnesota to help us out with our recycling. Matter of fact, if you're so good at your recycling that you can actually recycle more than what you sold, poundage, more than what you sold the state of Minnesota, we provided for credits so you can give it. You can sell those to somebody else. And we put the fee high at 50 cents so that it's not in their interest to have us do it. It's in their interest because to actually recycle themselves, because they should be able to do it cheaper. They should be able to do it cheaper, and we are looking for recycling poundage, not the dollars. We don't want to collect money. We want the recycling to occur. That's what this provision was trying to promote. And why the manufacturers disagree with that boggles my mind. I don't understand. But to try and get something passed, we agreed to say, okay, you can try it, you know, go with your Trust Me program, and when you don't do it, then the other program goes into place. I am extremely disappointed to see the dates get changed back to where we don't have something that's taking effect right away. I thought this thing was going to take off right away, so that because we know we have a deadline coming into place. No wonder the counties are upset with the whole program. And so that gives you some background. I'd be glad to answer any other questions on the concepts. You have to decide yourself as to what you can do with the amendments.
No further discussion. Representative Fulbert.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think this amendment is extremely important because it would go back to, as I understand it, the task force report. Is that correct, Representative Lugenius?
That's correct.
And what I think is so important is because if we don't do that, you have two choices. It's going to be in the road ditch, the county's going to pick up, or it's going to be the county's going to have to do it. And the property tax is going to have to do it. And it's more than just my CRT, it's all kinds of stuff. So, you know, trust me is a good thing to do. It's like the saying, I'm from the government, I'm here to help you.
Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know, I did go through this. I'm a little surprised sometimes that the labels are given. By the way, as far as time frame is concerned, the only change in time frame was just a registration thing. The actual responsibility to actually conduct the program, if you look in the delete all, on the second page starting in line 31, it says shall conduct, and this is the manufacturer, shall conduct beginning July 1st, 2007, a program for collection, transportation, recycling. That's taking on a responsibility. I do think, Mr. Chair, we've heard one side. I know that I was late, but it does seem to me that maybe we ought to hear a little bit from the manufacturer side. There's someone here that could be, because I read it as taking a significant responsibility. I don't see anything that says it's anything else but free enterprise. It might be a different way to do it than what was offered in the original proposal, and I appreciate the work that was done. But I don't think we've had a chance to hear, at least briefly, from the manufacturers for why their proposal is what they would like us to vote for, because that's what the amendment does, is change that. Would it be possible for us to hear briefly from the manufacturer's side?
Let's have some brief testimony from whoever is here from the manufacturers. We're from the manufacturers, and we're here to help you, Representative Solberg. If you could identify yourself, sir.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lloyd Grooms. I'm an attorney with the law firm Winthrop & Weinstein and represent the Electronic Manufacturers Coalition, a coalition of a number of electronic manufacturers, including Panasonic, Sharp, Sony, the popular names, as well as Apple and IBM. And I think maybe what I will do, given your request for simply brief remarks, is try to do a quick comparison between the programs. First of all, the manufacturer program is not a voluntary program. In both systems, manufacturers pay $5,000. In the manufacturer system, a manufacturer is required to not only register and pay $5,000, but to submit a plan to the state explaining how, in fact, they're going to conduct their recycling program. Within a year's time, they actually have to file another registration and explain exactly what they did do in their program, including reporting what recycling they actually did. Finally, in terms of working with the counties, there is provision in there to coordinate with counties and, in fact, to conduct a collection within the counties at least once a year in each county. So there is actually mandatory requirements in the manufacturer's response. In fact, if you look at the, if you will, the task force approach, it merely states that manufacturers must annually recycle a fixed number. It is no more prescriptive as to how, in fact, manufacturers do the recycling. So in both programs, manufacturers have the same latitude in terms of what recycling they do. So in essence, I believe that the programs are very comparable in terms of both the registration requirements as well as the recycling, the implementation of recycling programs. You will also notice that there are enforcement mechanisms within the both sections, if you will, of the bill that allow for enforcement to be taken against the manufacturer, and given your concern on the manufacturing standpoint, for manufacturers who fail to, in fact, register, submit a plan, or, in fact, conduct a plan. So in that sense, I think it's a bit more than simply a voluntary program. In fact, it is, I think, a very detailed program that manufacturers are going to conduct. The latitude comes in how you actually implement that program. While it's not defined, part of the idea is for manufacturers to actually work with both private and public entities to come up with the, if you will, creative solutions, whether that be, as happened in the past, where it may be manufacturers working with counties or other political subdivisions, working with waste haulers, working with other entities in terms of conducting that program. That's what the manufacturers would hope to do relative to the earlier comments. We manufacturers are hoping to have that opportunity to demonstrate that they can, through, if you will, free enterprise, demonstrate that they can, in fact, conduct the recycling that people all are trying to achieve here.
So, sir, you're speaking in favor of the Wagenius Amendment?
I am speaking in opposition to the Wagenius Amendment.
I'm going to be late here, so. I don't have the Wagenius Amendment in front of me, so I'm just. Okay, for questions for this witness? Representative Hamilton, for this witness, or just in general?
Okay. Well, I asked Representative Cox that I was going to be asking this question. Just to keep it simple, my wife is telling people back home that she's a widow and single parent because I'm never there. So the truth of the matter is if our TV breaks, she's going to have to get rid of it. Okay? So my question is this. Under the task force proposal, underneath the task force proposal, how does she dispose of it and what is the cost to her? And underneath the manufacturer's proposal, how does she dispose of it and what is the cost to her? So can we get that answer, please?
Okay, who wants to take the first one? How much will it cost and how does she get rid of it under the bill? Resident Cox, under your bill as it is now, how did, what does she do and how much does it cost her in Cottonwood County?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I address the task force language, I'll let Mr. Grooms address the manufacturer's language, but the task force language is very flexible. I will tell you that the number of and types of programs that are out there that can be used to recycle, the bill does not prescribe them, and I think that's important. And we may have collections depending on how big the cities your wife is close to. You may have a collection that's ongoing on a regular basis. You may have collections going on at county landfills on an ongoing regular basis. You may have events at a retailer where they're taking them into parking lot programs, whatever. You may have private people that she would be directed to if you called the county, and where they've made arrangements to have private collections on these. It could be really any kind of collection at all on the task force language. And the cost, most of those you may have no cost. If you decided you wanted to get rid of it immediately and just going to a private hauler, there's nothing preventing counties from arranging, for example, deposits or costs to be paid when you drop it off with a private hauler, or to the county too if they have a small fee that they need to pay for, you know, very quick service type stuff. And I'll let Mr. Grooms
wants to give the other piece of it. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the same would apply under the manufacturer's program.
To that point, Representative Krinke.
Well, Mr. Chairman, fresh from Tax Conference Committee, I was going to explain the way you do that, Representative Hamilton, is the same way I explained the property tax relief bill. Plop, plop, fizz, fizz.
How was your progress tonight, Representative Krinke?
Plop, plop, fizz, fizz. Mr. Chairman, we're making great progress in the Tax Conference Committee, so we've adopted provisions on federal conformity, and I think we might be able to wrap it up if we could get back down to the Tax Conference Committee.
If we don't want to hold you up, I have Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to make two motions. The first one is that we move the deposit in the solid waste dumps to July 1, 2007.
Are you on the Wagenius Amendment? Because that's what's before the body right now.
Well, let me hear my amendments first. And the second thing is, we refer this bill to the Committee on Environment and Natural Resources without further recommendation.
Okay. Representative Earhart, the clerk is not sure that we can do this as an amendment to the amendment, so could we act on the Wagenius Amendment? We'll come back to yours first.
Okay,
very good. Any further discussion, Representative Wagenius? You get the last word on your amendment.
Well, I would hope that we've heard from folks outside the state, manufacturers from outside the state. We do have folks from within the state, like Best Buy, and I think it might be wise just to hear a word from them.
And Mr. Chair?
Okay. Representative Cox?
Thank you. I do want to point out in the A30 amendment that's before you that the date changes. Somebody brought up an issue about whether this was going to happen in 2010 or 2006. Representative Virginius is bringing this forward, so the task force language starts happening right away, too, in 2006, in August of 2006. So that is addressed.
Okay. Who was it that Representative Wagenius wanted to have come forward for a very brief testimony? Mr. Anderson? Is there anyone left in the audience who has not testified? Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, hello. My name is Laura Bishop, and I'm with Best Buy.
My name is Buzz Anderson. I'm with the Minnesota Retailers Association.
And the Wagenius Amendment?
Yeah, this is the Wagenius Amendment. I just wanted to say that I sent a letter to every committee member today saying that we definitely support the task force proposal and the Wagenius Amendment. We had mentioned that we would be willing to work with manufacturers, but we have stated all along that our preference is for the task force model as presented by Representative Osmond some months ago.
What is the task force?
Mr. Chair, Best Buy supports the task force language. This is something that we worked on with the task force, and it's also something that is very similar to language that we've worked on in other states and in the Northeast and in the Midwest initiative that's been moving forward as well. In addition, with the model legislation that they're looking at, or the manufacturer's legislation, with some of the poundage that they're looking at for their goals that they've set, while it's admirable that they're setting goals, I do think that we need to kind of keep in perspective some of the amounts of waste that are there that the counties are taking in. And, you know, Best Buy does do recycling events, and we will continue to do those events. We are a manufacturer as well as a retailer, so we understand that we have a large role under this task force language where we will have to continue to do our recycling events, and we'll continue to play a large part in that. We also understand that we'll play a reporting role where we'll report into the state what our manufacturers are selling into the state on products, and we will comply with that as well. And we think that this is something that is good for Minnesota and good for the county. Thank you.
Any questions? Seeing none. On the A30 amendment, any further discussion? Seeing none. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay.
No.
It is here. The ayes have it. The amendment is adopted.
Division?
Division has been requested. Those in favor of the Wagenius amendment, please raise your hand. Those opposed to the amendment, please raise your hand. Oh. 17 ayes and 7 nays. The amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Rokavina.
100% Hamilton's wife vote on Hamilton.
Maybe watching us right now on our TV that's soon to break. Did we do done A31 yet, members? We have, okay. Representative Earhart had a oral amendment. Representative Earhart, do you want to still offer that?
No.
I'm hearing no.
Mr. Chairman, I'd rather go and spend 2 days on the floor debating. One day for explanation, the second day for debate and amendments.
By that time, we're done. Okay. So you'd rather not offer any amendments. Does anyone else have amendments that are written or otherwise?
No.
Okay. Seeing none, we'll go to third reading figuratively. And do we have any other discussion on the bill? Seeing none, the Representative Osment renews his motion.
This is not going anywhere.
Senate File 1298, be recommended to pass as amended and be referred to the General Register. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay.
No.
You can share the ayes have it and the bill is passed. Members, watch your calendars for further Ways and Means meetings. The meeting is adjourned.